This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we will be discussing the proposed flag desecration amendment to the Constitution.
You might be flying the flag this 4th of July. You might call for peace on your flag or fly it upside down, indicating distress. And this may be your last 4th of July to do it.
We'll also be joined by our very own Michael Ratner to give us an update on what's happening in Guantanamo.
President Clinton, former President Carter, and others have joined the growing calls to shut down Guantanamo Bay. Find out where you can protest today and what you can do to add your voice.
All of that and a lot more today on Law and Disorder.
Welcome to our special July 4th edition of Law and Disorder.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, ACLU's Arab Muslim South Asian Advocate.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like. Today, we'd like to extend a special welcome to our new affiliates, KSOW in Cottage Grove, Oregon, WYAP in West Virginia, and WRFM in Nashville, Tennessee. And listeners in those areas, please log on to our website, lawanddisorder.org, to let us know what's happening in your area.
July 4th has traditionally been a time to celebrate America, but I think these days it should become more of a time to take stock of where we are from July 4th to July 4th. We're losing civil liberty so quickly, and as things change, we need to use this opportunity to reflect on where America is and how to move it to where we need it to be. Today's show will discuss some of those issues and give you a chance to reflect. Please log on to lawanddisorder.org, send us your feedback, your thoughts, and what you think the most pressing civil liberties issues today are.
16 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that flag burning was a form of protected speech, an expression of freedom. That ruling threw out a 1968 federal statute and flag protection laws in 48 states, a law created in response to anti-Vietnam War protesters burning flags at demonstrations. Since then, Congress has been trying ever since to strip this freedom. The last time was in 2000 when it failed 63-37 in the Senate. Senator Orrin Hatch is now sponsoring a proposed amendment to ban flag desecration, saying he finds it offensive conduct and not speech. By a 286-130, 8 more than needed vote, House members approved the amendment after debating such a ban, if such a ban would run counter to the free speech protections. Advocates and opponents both say it stands the best chance of passage this year.
With us, we have Gary May. Gary May joined the U.S. Marines in 1967. During the 1968 Tet Offensive, May had to have both legs amputated after a landmine explosion. He's the recipient of the Bronze Star with Combat V, the Purple Heart with Star, as well as the Vietnam Campaign, Vietnam Service, and National Defense Medals. Today, in addition to teaching at the University of Southern Indiana, May is the chair of Veterans Defending the Bill of Rights, a group dedicated to defeating the constitutional amendment to allow laws banning mistreatment of the flag. His reasons are simple and poignant. Gary says, "Freedom of expression, even when it hurts, is the truest test of our dedication to the belief that we have that right."
Welcome, Gary May, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
Gary, the Senate is expected to take this up again shortly after the 4th of July holiday. If approved by the needed two-thirds vote, what happens after that?
Well, if it passes the Senate, then it would go to the states for ratification, requiring 38 states to ratify the amendment, which I would suspect would be quite probable, given that most of the states, if not all, have already passed legislation either encouraging Congress to pass this amendment or otherwise expressing support for it.
And I think I heard that by most counts, 65 current senators have voted for or said they intend to support the amendment.
Yeah, the margin appears to be razor thin. Two votes really are the only thing that seem to separate us from the passage of this amendment.
So what happens if the amendment's actually passed? What does that mean practically?
Well, I think as a matter of practicality, it means something of quite historic significance in that it would be the first infringement in the Constitution on the Bill of Rights, notably the guarantee of free speech. That really is the issue. In previous court decisions, rulings have been consistent that this form of expression is protected speech, and it would be a curtailment of that First Amendment guaranteed freedom if that happens. I think in terms of, from a veteran perspective, a practical implication for many of us would be that it would be seen as a slap in our faces, because at the same time that patriotism and honoring veterans gets used by the other side in support of this amendment, those of us who served honorably and served clearly in defense of the Constitution, not in defense of the flag, would feel that our service would be trivialized and dismissed. And in the context of veteran services and veterans affairs, the flag amendment really is of no real consequence in terms of having any kind of beneficial effect.
You testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee in March 2004 and very eloquently said, "This is among the freedoms for which I fought and gave part of my body."
Absolutely. It was for the freedoms and for the values and for what's embodied in the Constitution and Bill of Rights, not for the symbol of those things. Having said that, though, I do not advocate disrespecting or maltreatment of the flag, and it's not something that I would do. But I think it's quite a stretch from that to say that we ought to have some sort of onerous amendment to the Constitution to protect that very symbol of the free speech that would be curtailed in the name of protecting the symbol. And it's not an honorable thing to do.
And you're not alone. I'm sure you're aware that the First Amendment Center recently did a survey showing that 63% of those sampled say the Constitution should not be amended.
Yes. That is absolutely
And that's
true.
A 10% increase from just a year ago.
Right.
So why now? I mean, if you look back, if you go to our website, ACLU.org, and you look up this issue, Flag Desecration Amendment, or even if you look up Gary May, you'll find that this issue pops up again and again over the years. I'm holding in my hands your testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee from April of 1999.
Yes.
Why now are we so close if this issue has been popping up again and again?
Well, I think one of the reasons is the way the election went last time, where people who might be more inclined to oppose this either were not returned to office, or other people who are more inclined to support the amendment were brought to office. I think part of it, too, is that right now, as we continue to be engaged in the war with Iraq and you know, people are interested in voicing and demonstrating their support to the troops. And when this amendment gets presented in the context of honoring veterans and implicitly current service members, then I think it becomes a quite dangerous set of circumstances where people who don't really examine the implications think that, well, it seems like or it feels like the right thing to do, so that's something that we'll support.
Well, what are the implications? We were thinking about this on an everyday level and thinking about if using flag in artwork could then be considered desecration of the flag, or flying the flag upside down to indicate distress, or even wearing a flag bikini, as you sometimes see, if those things would be considered flag desecration.
they could very well be. The amendment is quite simply worded. It essentially empowers Congress to protect take actions to protect the flag. First of all, the flag would have to be defined, as you suggest. What is a flag? Is a flag as part of apparel a flag, or is it a shirt? Is a flag, when used as a bumper strip on a car, is that a flag, or is that part of a political campaign? And then also defining desecration. You know, what does that mean? The flag is burned regularly, and it's burned regularly by patriotic, good-spirited, good-hearted people as a part of the formal and legitimized retirement ceremony for a damaged flag. So there are a lot of quagmires that would be introduced if this passed. The other issue, I think, that people really ought to understand, it's a non-problem. Even supporters of the amendment say that in 2005, there were only 3 episodes of actual flag desecration. 3. Now, if we're not choking and coughing in America because of the smoke in the air from burning flags, it's a non-problem. That in concert with the fact that it has such dire implications on our First Amendment guaranteed freedoms.
If this passes, what do you think the implications will be for other First Amendment protected activities?
It's hard to say, but I think, you know, it would at least, it seems to me, set a precedent. If it is deemed unconstitutional because of this amendment to, quote, desecrate, close quote, the flag, then why would it not be unconstitutional, or could it not be made unconstitutional, to criticize political leaders?
Well, we're already seeing a lot of that.
Well, yeah, but it doesn't enjoy the heavy weaponry, the heavy force,
right,
of a constitutional amendment.
Yeah,
right.
And that's
good
a whole
point.
Different story. So, Gary, what can listeners do who are concerned about this?
I think listeners absolutely need to let their senators right now, their U.S. senators, know, especially if they think this is a bad idea, they need to let them know that it is a very bad idea. I understand you have listeners in Colorado, and Senator Ken Salazar, freshman senator there, recently announced that he plans to be a co-sponsor, is a co-sponsor of this measure in the Senate. People in Colorado ought to let Senator Salazar know if they think this is a bad idea. And one of the questions I think for the senator is, does he want his first year as a U.S. senator to be characterized as the year that this amendment made it out of the Senate and for it to have his support? So senators need to hear from their constituents about this issue. And we ought to, I think, increase the dialogue among ordinary citizens about this. And we can do that through letters to the editor, through talking to people, through bringing it up in the organizations, civic clubs, and to really understand how close we are to this thing passing and for this infringement on our First Amendment freedoms to become part of our culture.
Gary, I think that's an excellent suggestion and one of the most patriotic things that listeners might do this week.
I think so, too. I mean, as veterans and you know, veterans defending the Bill of Rights, and we certainly know that it's not just veterans who oppose this. And, you know, I think the additional cachet that veterans have on this issue is that the other side is using the honorable service as veterans as one of the selling points for this. And Veterans Defending the Bill of Rights is out there to say that certainly not all veterans support this.
Thank you so much, Gary May, and have a very happy 4th of July.
Good work.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye.
Today, on July 4th, a diverse coalition including individuals and organizations ranging from Eve Ensler to the Center for Constitutional Rights and the Culture Project are asking people across the United States to join the call to shut down the Guantanamo Bay prison camp and demand an immediate independent investigation into the widespread allegations of abuse taking place there. Today, New Yorkers can go to Herald Square at 34th Street and 6th Avenue from 10, so it already started, to 12 noon to protest. Joining us by phone is our co-host, Michael Ratner, president of CCR. Michael, why now?
Well, I really want to thank you for talking about what's going on today. If people want more information about the protest today and about how to get active to shut down Guantanamo and end torture, they should go to the CCR website, ccr-ny.org. That's ccr-ny.org. You can print out American flags that say torture is immoral and unpatriotic, shut down Guantanamo. You can print out stickers. You can get a reading of the play going. Lots of good activities on this website. Go there and do this. Dahlia, the question, why now? Well, it's July 4th, and it's the day that we supposedly are supposed to demonstrate and be in favor of and support freedom in the United States, because that's what we supposedly won on July 4th. And the question, it reminds me of when it was said and celebrated July 4th during slavery, and Douglas, I think, said, what is your July 4th when we're keeping slaves? And the question I would have for our listeners and for the American people in general is, what is July 4th when we are holding people in indefinite detention, abusing them, not giving them trials, not only in Guantanamo, but in torture centers throughout the world? And so the question we should look at and reflect on is here, is this is a July 4th for freedom, supposedly, but in fact we are now keeping imprisoned not only millions of people that are in prison here, but keeping prisoners around the world, Muslim people, who have gotten no due process rights at all. It also coincides with the one-year anniversary of the opinion in Razul v. Bush. Razul v. Bush was the case the Center for Constitutional Rights won on June 28th last year that said that Guantanamo detainees have the right to due process of law. They have the right to walk into a court and ask the United States government, why am I being held? Well, it's a good time to evaluate also at this time, what has happened in 1 year? Well, the bad that has happened is the United States government, the Bush administration, has resisted every inch of the way, every single inch. First, they said you don't have a right to attorneys. Then when we won that, they said we have a right to wiretap the attorneys while you're in with your client conferences. You need security clearances. All your notes have to be looked at. And then in the end, they said, even though you got into court because of the Razul decision, the courthouse is empty. And while you're in the court, there's no rights once you're in the court. And so now they're litigating that. And again, we won in the district court on that. We're on appeal now on that, and it's going to be another 1-2 years. Who knows how long it'll be. So that's the bad news. The Bush administration has dug in. It's still keeping people there. The good news is, of course, that we've been able to mobilize some 400 attorneys across the country to be able to participate and represent 200 or so of the Guantanamo detainees. And they're fighting like dogs really hard. But again, the government is resisting. So the good news is there's a fight going on. There's a move in the country for sure to shut down Guantanamo, to end torture, end indefinite detention, and end summary justice and disappeared people. Now, of course, during all of this over the last few weeks, we've seen the exposés about the CORAN. We've seen Newsweek take a dive on it. We've seen the attack on Amnesty International. And the administration, of course, is now not just attacking. They're leading what I would call Cook's Tours. Cook is a travel company, of course, and Cook's Tours to Guantanamo for members of Congress and journalists. And those Cook's Tours and what people see in when they go to Guantanamo are essentially a Potemkin village, a false village that looks like a movie set. And these congressmen are coming back saying, and I think they want to be tricked because they want to somehow support the administration.
Congressman Hunter said that it was a world-class detention facility with superior health care, saying people there had more visits than average Americans do per year.
Not only is there not great health care, that's putting it mildly, what they're actually having doctors do, according to many of the reports, is is determined per detainee by detainee how much abuse and torture they can take and what their breaking points are.
And what kind of torture gets to them.
Exactly. What kind of... So not only, I mean, what kind of medical care people are getting, and I just saw a Voice of America video that showed some detainee having his knee fixed, but in fact, of course, doctors are playing a very, very nasty role there. And the torture that has come out from Guantanamo in a variety of different ways is absolutely confirmed. So what these congressmen got there is really nothing but, as I said, the Cook's tour, and none of it deals with the fundamental problem. The fundamental problem at Guantanamo right now is no one has had a trial. The government has not charged anybody, and we're saying at the center, and other groups are saying as well, you either charge people or release them.
The government is then in violation of the Supreme Court decision.
Our view is they treated the Supreme Court decision like a suggestion and not an order, but unfortunately, although we won in the court going back again, they're up on appeal again, and we'll probably have to take the Supreme Court to slam them again, I hope.
Well, how long do you have to fight it through the courts before the government complies?
The problem here is this is a court fight that we're winning, but it's not helping our clients that much, except that by keeping the pressure on, slowly some clients are being released. And I think there's been a buildup across the country now of people saying, what is going on at Guantanamo? And I think that's a reflection of, I think, the dissatisfaction in the Muslim world with the way the U.S. is carrying out the war on terror, and particularly Guantanamo is becoming a symbol of that. And as people recognize that this is angering people and making us less safe, I think they're finally in this country saying maybe we ought to get rid of this open eyesore of Guantanamo. The problem for us, of course, is getting rid of an open eyesore of Guantanamo is a great thing, and those people ought to be charged or released who are there, our clients. But at the same time, if the practices of Guantanamo, and those practices are three or four that I can mention, one is detention without trial, putting someone in jail just because you want them in jail and never trying them. Secondly, is using torture and other forms of abuse to interrogate them. Thirdly, is not giving out their names to their families so that they're essentially disappeared. And fourthly, if and when you do try them by summary justice. If those practices are simply going to move from Guantanamo to secret facilities around the world where some of that is already going on, in fact, a lot of it, then we will not have had a great gain by shutting down Guantanamo. We have to not just shut Guantanamo down, we have to actually end the practices that make Guantanamo what it is.
And what are the chances that that's going to happen?
Well, I think we're moving strongly. I mean, 4 years ago, I would have said no chance at all when this thing started, or 3.5 years ago. I think there's a move on now to actually figure out what to do about Guantanamo and give people some due process down there that they can be processed. But the administration has dug in. There's no doubt about it. Although, you know, when you hear congressmen talking about closing Guantanamo, you did have a bunch of Democrats say it and some Republicans, and then you have what I call this Cook's tour to try and overcome that. But
and Cheney saying publicly outrageous statements like, these people are treated better in Guantanamo than they are in their home countries.
It is amazing. Not only is he saying that, he's saying these are people who are bad people, who are killers, the 20th hijacker and all those people. Now, there may be some people down at Guantanamo who, if tried, could be convicted of terrorism. That's conceivable. But the only way we're going to know that is by charging them and bringing them to trial. I do know that my experience, and I've visited not only my Tipton clients in the United Kingdom, but I recently was there a few weeks ago, and I visited Mozambique, who not only was a Guantanamo detainee, he was considered so bad by the administration that they were going to put him before one of the special tribunals, one of 12 people. And he was put in isolation for 2 years, and he was released back to England, and he's walking the streets, and he's a very nice guy. And this is a guy they called the worst of the worst. So you see the administration lying, straight through its teeth all the time. Why any of these congressmen would go down there and say, oh, it's hunky-dory in Guantanamo, is remarkable to me.
Michael, do you have an accurate figure of how many people are still down there?
About 520 people remain in Guantanamo. We represent 200 and some. We've also filed a case called Doe, a name for an anonymous plaintiff, Doe v. Bush 1 through 570, to cover everybody else, and we believe we now represent everybody, but of course that's not accepted by the Bush administration.
Go to ccr-ny.org, hit the Guantanamo Action Center. There's lots to do. You can even, I know a lot of you out there have book clubs. there is a Guantanamo reading project that you can join. So download the stickers, download the information, and if you're able to, pop up or down to 34th Street and 6th Avenue, Herald Square, from now until noon. Thanks, Michael.
Thanks Michael.
Guys.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org. You can get the show on there. You can ask questions. You can email us. We want to hear from you. Please let us know how you like the show and any questions you have. Thanks.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say.
We want to follow up on one of our segments from our last show. Kamal Issahab and his two brothers, Hussein and Hassan, who have lived in the United States for most of their lives and came here as children from Morocco, found themselves in deportation proceedings following their registration with the government's special registration program. The special registration program is a program that registered mainly Muslim men from 25 Muslim-majority countries. 82,000 men registered with the government and 13,000 found themselves in deportation proceedings, forced to leave. Today, three of them have been subtracted from that list. The prosecutor dropped the case against Kamal Hussein and Hassan Issahab. While we're thrilled that the three of them get to stay and continue living their lives in America, there are many thousands of others who have not received any publicity on their cases, have not had the benefits of lawyers who are willing to work for free on their behalf, and have not had law students and activists writing to the government on their behalf. And each day, they are the ones who are deported silently. If you'd like to hear our interview with Kamal and his attorney, Julie Dinnerstein, please log on to lawanddisorder.org and listen to our last show. We're looking back to some of the best of our segments, from the National Security State with Michael Avery to the John Brown Book Review. In addition, you can catch all past programs that you may have missed on lawanddisorder.org.
Joining us now to talk about the National Security State is Professor Michael Avery, President of the National Lawyers Guild and Constitutional Law Professor at Suffolk Law School in Boston. Welcome, Michael, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you. Hi, Michael. It's Michael Smith. You know, when last I saw you, it was in Birmingham, Alabama, at the National Lawyers Guild convention. You gave such a good talk there, and we're grateful to have you on the air. We wanted to ask you if you might recap for us what you said then about the real degeneration in democratic rights in this country and what you think we can expect in the coming year.
Well, you know, I think most Americans have blithely assumed that our experiment in constitutional democracy would just go on forever. But I'm afraid that we're going to follow the path of most regimes and certainly all empires, and that we're now looking at the demise of our constitutional democracy and the creation in America of a national security state.
And what do you mean by that?
What I mean by a national security state is one in which the executive department is really running the government, where we've eliminated much of the protection that is afforded by separation of powers, where there's little or no judicial review of principal decisions that are made by the executive department, particularly those relating to security, where we have a visible increase in uniform security in our society, less accountability for law enforcement, spying on targeted individuals and groups, and increased surveillance of the citizenry generally, and a society that's organized around a national mission that, at least on its face, claims it has something to do with protecting our security.
Unhappily, I totally agree with you. It's been before, but especially since 9/11, just, you know, shocking, the boldness and the aggressiveness that they've shown in unfolding that agenda. Just recently, with the latest law they've passed on the Homeland Security Act, I think they've taken giant steps in the wrong direction. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Let's just consider one example of what the government is now able to do, which is the use of national security letters by the government. This is something that has received much less attention in the public press than it deserves. There's a lot of concern about the ability of the government to find out what library books you're reading and so on and so forth. But actually, much more important than that is the fact that the FBI now has the power, under the Patriot Act and the Homeland Security Act, to send letters to those institutions in society that keep many of our most private records, financial institutions, medical providers, credit agencies, banks, and the like. And to get information about us from these different institutions without any subpoena, without any court review, with no opportunity for those of us whose records are collected in this way to challenge what's happening. And in fact, all this takes place without the knowledge of the people whose records are being gathered, because it's a felony for anybody who receives one of these national security letters from the government to inform the person whose records are being collected. Now, this really stands a lot of our constitutional protections on their heads. In the ordinary course, in order to get private information about a person, the government has to go first to a court and convince a judge that there's sufficient reason, some sufficient governmental interest, usually having to do with some proof that the person's involved in criminal activity, some sufficient reason to invade that person's privacy. But what we see under the Patriot Act and under the Homeland Security Act is an ability by the government to invade in a dragnet fashion the privacy of thousands and millions of Americans with no judicial review whatsoever.
And no one knows this is happening for the most part.
For the most part, nobody knows what they're doing. We only learned a little bit about it last year because in a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit that the ACLU filed, the government turned over some information about what it had been doing. I'm quite certain only the tip of the iceberg. But even from that tip of the iceberg, we could see that the records they were gathering are staggering. Just to give you an example, anybody who visited Las Vegas during the last 2 weeks of the last calendar year had their records, their hotel records, their flight records, their rental car records, all were collected by the government. Everybody who visited Las Vegas during that period of time, their records were swept up in this dragnet search. That's a staggering idea.
Why, Michael?
Why, yeah.
Evidently, the government had some information, we don't even know what it was, that something may have been happening in Las Vegas during that period of time that the government claimed was related to national security, and all they have to do is have the thinnest of reasons for that, and then instead of focusing the investigation on a particular person or a particular place, they can conduct this type of dragnet investigation.
Las Vegas Tourism Bureau this past year has been doing an advertising campaign with the slogan, "What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas."
That's funny. Mike, we've got Michael Avery, president of the National Lawyers Guild, on the line. Michael, comment for us, will you, on the Homeland Security Act's provision to make a unified national driver's license and also a unified national birth certificate. What's the meaning of that?
Well, you know, it's interesting. If we go back to 1935, when the Social Security Act was adopted, and when Americans were assigned a Social Security number, there was a huge debate in Congress at that time about whether that Social Security number would become a universal identification number. And in fact, written into the law was the notion that the use of the Social Security number would have to be limited. And then, as recently as 1968, when the Privacy Act was passed, it was underlined that government agencies are not allowed to use the Social Security number as a universal identification number. What we have now...
Well, Michael, on that, how come everybody does, though? I knew about that law, but every time I get a form of any sort, it asks me for my Social Security number.
Well, first of all, the law doesn't apply to private information gatherers, but just to the government. And secondly, most government agencies ignore it. So that has pretty much been thrown out the window, but I mention it to show that Americans have always been suspicious and have always tried to protect themselves from some form of internal passport control in this country. Now, the questions you asked about the driver's license and so on are clear steps toward adopting some type of internal passport. And if you think about it, the functions of an internal passport are already being performed when you go to the airport and you have to show some state-issued identification, usually your driver's license, to get on the airplane. They even have that on Amtrak now. When you go to pick up your ticket, you're supposed to show your identification. It's going to be that when you check into a hotel or when you use public services, you'll have to show that identification, so that the government's ability to track us, to track all of our movements all the time, has expanded hugely. And not satisfied with the idea of making people show identification, there are now more and more proposals for the installation of global tracking devices, GPS, global positioning
system.
These GPS devices are being installed on automobiles, cell phones. There are even some medical providers who are urging parents to install them under their children's skin so that if the children are kidnapped, they can be found.
Like they do for pets now.
They're going to do it for people. And so we are going to have virtually no ability to remain anonymous. And the significance of that is that anonymity is very important to dissent. Anonymity is very important to giving people the sense of freedom and the confidence that they can dissent from their government's policies, that they can protest, that they can raise questions about what's happening in their country without losing their job, without being subjected to a variety of penalties. But we are at serious risk of losing that anonymity completely.
Michael, can you give any suggestions for listeners about what kinds of things we can do on a day-to-day level to fight back?
Well, I think, first of all, people have to inform themselves about what's happening. And secondly, I think people have to begin to insist at every opportunity that they have that the terrorism concern that is fueling all of this is grossly overblown. I saw that yesterday Richard Goldstone, who was the first chief prosecutor at the war crimes tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda, came out and made a statement that the United States terror war is a complete overreaction. People need to do something to restore their confidence in our safety in this country. The administration has succeeded in turning us into a nation of frightened sheep, and we need to, you know, we need to take back ownership of our own society.
So how do you do it, Michael?
Well, I think people have to organize. I think people have to go to the Democratic politicians in this country who have been running, you know, with rare exceptions. Barbara Boxer comes to mind for standing up to Condoleezza Rice. But with rare exceptions like that, the Democrats have been running away from the Constitution and away from our civil liberties almost as fast as the Republicans. We have to go to our elected officials, whether on a local level, like the Bill of Rights Defense Committee does, where people have passed these local resolutions against the Patriot Act, or on a national level, to our senators and congressmen. We have to let people know that they have to fight back against this.
Michael, our producer just passed us a note, and I want to ask you this, saying that there's a sophisticated tracking system embedded in U.S. currency. Have you heard about that?
I have not.
Have you heard about their putting biometrics on driver's license and birth certificates?
I have heard that. Yes, I have heard that.
Is that a proposal, or is that a fact, or is that a fantasy? What have you heard?
I don't know whether that's been instituted or not.
By biometrics, you mean a way of identifying the person whose card that is through that person's makeup or biology? Is that the idea?
Yeah. Put your DNA. Encode your DNA on your driver's license.
You did hear the one I read, I'm sure, the other day, Michael, that for getting through the lines rapidly when you're leaving the country or entering the country, you can have your iris scanned and do iris scans, and they're going to test this at Kennedy, and then after you have your iris scanned and they identify you like that, you also, to get the special card, you get interviewed by someone from Homeland Security, and then you can get the special...
The trusted traveler.
Right, and then you the trusted traveler, and then you can go right in and out. I don't think that, I won't speak for everybody here, but I'm sure that some of the people on this program won't make it through the iris scan.
Well, you know, Michael, what they're creating with some of these things is a two-tier society. And we already have that. I read an article in the paper yesterday about Hartford, Vermont. Hartford, Vermont, which is 100 miles from the Canadian border, has a checkpoint that you have to go through. And the people of color in that community call it the White Pass checkpoint or something, because if you're white, you sail right through. And if you're African American, or if you appear to be Muslim or Arab or South Asian, you don't sail right through.
It's exactly like what happened up at Buffalo when Muslims who attended a conference in Toronto were trying to get back into the country, many of them who live right there on the border in the United States, all of whom had U.S. passports, were held for 6-7 hours while their identity was checked, while they were fingerprinted, while they were photographed. And they watched white people sail straight through the border.
Well, you know, people ask about many of these things that we've been talking about this morning. They say, What's the danger? What's the problem with all of this? But the underlying problems, you know, it's not privacy for privacy's sake, although that's important, but the underlying problems are the elimination of free speech, the right to dissent, and the creation of a caste society where we have people who are much worse off than others because of their ethnic background.
Michael, this is chilling, really, what you've said.
Well, I think people need to wake up, and we need to make some demands on people in this country with some power to get in the way of what's happening.
Michael Avery, thank you very much. We've come to the end of the segment, but we certainly appreciate Michael Avery, head of the National Lawyers Guild, being on Law and Disorder. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Really terrific interview, Michael.
Bye, Michael.
Bye.
Our next guest is Jemana Musa. She's a lawyer and staff member of Amnesty International's UN section. She's one of the people that's going to talk to us today about the Amnesty International report. People may be aware the AI or Amnesty International report caused a huge controversy out there for a number of reasons. I've read the report. It's a fantastic report, really detailed, really nails down the U.S. as a violator of basic fundamental human rights, prohibition against torture, indefinite detentions, etc. But what really got at least the right wing up, and then President Bush, Vice President Cheney, and Condoleezza Rice, was the use of the word gulag in the AI, not in the report, but I think in the comments made afterwards. But in any case, we're here really to talk about what that report says, what it means for America, and what AI really thinks of the impact and the controversy going on right now. So welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
So give us some sense of the summary of what the main conclusions of the report are.
Well, I think it's important to remember, although you wouldn't necessarily get that sense from the comments we've seen in the press, that this is actually our annual report, which covers just about every country in the world in terms of what we found in the year of 2004 in human rights violations in all these countries. So although it's been painted as some kind of single-minded attack on the U.S., it's a report that covers the world as Amnesty International always has. In particular, when it comes to the United States, this year did focus quite a bit on allegations of mistreatment of detainees in U.S. custody, either those who are acknowledged to be in custody or those who have been disappeared into custody into place, you know, parts unknown. And so that's what we've seen, you know, a lot of the ire get up about. And I think really what's happened is this sort of tunnel vision focus on the word gulag has been used to distract people from what the actual message is, which is no matter what you call it, no matter what terminology you attach to it, there's a huge body of evidence at this point of torture and ill-treatment in U.S. facilities, whether it's in Guantanamo, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, or in parts unknown. There's a large body of evidence that the Secretary of Defense himself was involved in hiding some prisoners from the Red Cross and others. There is a large body of evidence that shows that it's not only, although it's been painted this way by some of the administration comments, a few people who have gone home disgruntled and are peddling the lies about the U.S., but we've seen it in FBI reports. We've seen it in government investigations. We've seen it in photos. We've
seen it document after document. I think that's what's critical here, you know, because when I heard both Bush and Cheney say, well, these guys, these detainees are a bunch of liars, I happen to have interviewed a number of them and don't think they are, but putting that aside, what about the fact, as you just pointed out, that there's FBI documents out there saying we witnessed these kinds of things at Guantanamo?
And I think that's the question that the administration is trying to avoid answering. I mean, what they've been telling us is that, well, every allegation has been investigated transparently. But what we know is that the majority of these investigations have not been independent, they have not been transparent, and large portions of them end up classified, like the Church report. We got a 21-page executive summary of a 378-page report, yet they claim to be independent and transparent. And it just simply doesn't hold water.
Now, do you recall what some of the FBI allegations were?
Oh, absolutely. We've seen allegations of putting cigarettes out in detainees' ears, lit cigarettes into detainees' ears, allegations of people being chained to the floor in a fetal position, left in extreme temperatures with music blaring and lights on. We've seen just sort of document after document where even the FBI themselves said that the information, because that's one of the defenses that we heard from, I believe it was Vice President Cheney, that they're getting good actionable intelligence from Guantanamo. One of the things that came out in the FBI emails from Guantanamo was saying not only were they concerned about any kind of FBI involvement or association with some of these interrogation techniques, but also that the intelligence that was being gathered was suspect at best when it came to all of the types of the interrogation methods they were using. And I think another important thing to remember is the intelligence community, the military community, has always known that torture has never gotten good intelligence, ever. And I think one of the clearest things that the government, again, hasn't come back to refute was the fact that a couple of the British detainees they had had confessed at some point. They said they were being tortured, so they just said sure to everything. And they confessed.
Yeah, in fact, you know, those were my clients, the Tipton guys.
Yeah.
And I interviewed them in England, and they confessed to meeting Osama bin Laden, being trained in the Al-Farouq training camp. And they said, what else could we do? We were being essentially tortured, and what else could we do to get our conditions better, we thought.
Exactly. And they got released because, as you know, the British intelligence officials were able to show they actually weren't in Afghanistan at that time. With it.
You know, the one thing, Jemana, that we got out of the Schlesinger panel, which I think is great, which I'm sure you use all the time, mm-hmm. is that Appendix E that lists the approved methods that Rumsfeld mm-hmm. himself approved, which includes forcible grooming, use of uh-huh. dogs, stress positions, taking away of comfort items, e.g. religious items. That means the Koran. So you have Rumsfeld himself essentially approving the very things that you guys are accusing the government of having done. And then you have Bush and Cheney saying it's all a lie. We really appreciate this. Thank you very much, and really congratulations to Amnesty on a report that everybody ought to go to the website. You should say it once more. Look at that report. It's a real indictment of the Bush administration. It really talks about the application of the Pinochet principle and really tells you what our country is doing around the world right now. Say the website once more for us, Jemana.
It's www.aiusa.org.
Well, thanks again.
Thank you.
John Brown and off to war. We're really excited to have our next guest here. His name is David Reynolds. He's a distinguished professor of English and American study at Baruch College and CUNY. But most of all, and very excitingly, he is the author of a new book on John Brown, and it's making real waves in the world of history, Civil War, and what was the role and purpose of what John Brown did at Harper's Ferry. David Reynolds, it's nice to have you on the show. Tell our listening audience what the subtitle of your book is, would you please?
Well, the subtitle is The Man Who Killed Slavery, Sparked the Civil War, and Ceded Civil Rights.
And in a nutshell, how did he do that?
Well, he did it by standing up. See, in my view, America was nuts at the time. It wasn't John Brown who was nuts. America was the crazy one. Why? Because all the laws were lined up on behalf of slavery. He was the one Northerner who took up arms against slavery, and it was his assault on Harper's Ferry, West Virginia, it was Virginia, with 21 men that polarized the nation to such a degree that war became virtually inevitable at that point, and it was the war that ended slavery. His speech before the Virginia court it was less than 300 words, and it was completely unpremeditated. It was just an expression of his racial views and his views on slavery. That speech, Emerson called it, as great as the Gettysburg Address. Emerson
yes.
said there were two great speeches, the John Brown speech and the Gettysburg Address. We see the world today held in the grip of terrorists. They're almost non-existent in their numbers in terms of the world, the numbers of people living in the world, and yet they're determining the whole policy of the world. And John Brown was... You can call him a revolutionary or a terrorist for a good cause. And the good cause is to get rid of slavery and to restore equal rights for people of all ethnicities. And he had a plan of freeing some slaves in the area, retreating to the mountains that he knew very well because he was a surveyor. And these mountains extend very deep into the south, and spreading what today we might call terrorist cells that would then raid the plantations and create such incredible disruption, spark slave revolts and slave insurrections, that the South would say, okay, we're willing to compromise. There was nothing that the South feared more than slave rebellions, and John Brown knew that. He wanted to tickle that fear. He wanted to prompt it and to force a compromise by using guerrilla tactics from the mountains.
Yeah, that's exactly the word that comes to mind, guerrilla tactics. And I think that his calculation was that if this is successful, it'll actually save lives, given what could happen if there was a civil war between the North and the South.
Exactly,
and as it turns
yeah.
out, as you say in your book, that war costs more casualties than all the other wars in American history.
Yes, all other wars combined. But I think he did a favor by prompting that war, because I think the war was inevitable. It was going to come later anyway, and if it had been later, who knows? I mean, as it was, the South almost won the war twice. Of course, the North eventually won the war, but it almost lost it a couple of times. And there's no guarantee the South wouldn't have won a later war. And I think there would have been a later war. So I think that John Brown, his initial plan, which was to terrorize the South out of slavery, was the best one. But then, sadly enough, the second best one was a civil war.
Yeah, exactly. Could you finish, Professor Reynolds, could you finish that point you were making about John Brown's speech just prior to being convicted and condemned and hung, his 300-word speech to the jury that day?
Yeah, it was a very eloquent speech. And Henry David Thoreau said John Brown didn't make any effect with his rifles, as it turned out. He could have, but because he had a good plan. But he made an effect with his words. Because his words were disseminated throughout America and throughout the world, mainly by people who hated him, because the pro-slavery reporters, who were the main people who had access to him, of course reprinted his words, because of course they knew he was totally nuts, and everything he was saying about equality between whites and blacks was the silliest thing that was ever said. So of course they would reprint his words, ha-ha. But what really happened is a few people in the North, like Thoreau and like Emerson, said, no, wait a second. This guy is not nuts. This guy, in fact, they put him on the level of Jesus Christ. And when Emerson put him on the level of Jesus Christ, then the world started listening and paying attention.
I just wanted to thank Professor Reynolds. He's a distinguished professor here at CUNY Graduate School and Baruch College. He's written just a great book on John Brown. Thank you.
David, this was really an honor. Thank you very much.
It was an honor to be here. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks for listening to Law and Disorder, and a special thanks to today's guests, Gary May and Michael Ratner. Thanks also to Michael Avery. Law and Disorder is produced by Jeff Brady. For questions and to give comments, please log on to our website, lawanddisorder.org.
I'm here to tell you about destruction of all the evil that will have to end. Struggle just to stay.